I have a strange feeling that my life may be about to take a new direction because my longtime, there are two reasons. One of them is that my longtime partner in public performance, Bob Scott, seems to be getting more and more irresistible. He has so many choir members now, he can't even sit over there with them. He told me years ago this would happen. The other thing is that if your longtime wife wakes up in the morning and tells you that she has had a dream, and that in that dream, she has been in the back seat of an automobile with George Bush. I think I need to see somebody. We always have some welcome guests who are here for the first time, so I need to put this morning's sermon in context by explaining to you that the prophet I talk about today is the third of several men who revolutionized the Jewish religion about 700 years ago. Amos got it started. Hosea kept it going. We talked about both of them on the last two Sundays. And we close the series with a man named Micah. It may be unfortunate that these men are called prophets because they were primarily interested in the present. They were not so much predictors as they were passionate teachers who set out to interpret the will of God for their own time. All three of them survive in messages that are couched in poetry rather than ordinary speech, which makes them much harder to translate into another language. Try putting your favorite Robert Frost or Emily Dickinson poem into French or Spanish or whatever language you studied, and you'll know instantly what I mean. But there's another translation difficulty as well. The textbooks of these great teachers are often in very bad shape. Words and sentences that are no longer intelligible, lines that have dropped out, additions made by later copyists, enough to drive a translator half out of his mind. What it means, of course, is that it took a long time before the writings of these men came to be thought of as sacred literature, to be fixed and guarded forever against any more change. Micah, for some unknown reason, fared better in this regard than Amos or Hosea. But this does not mean that all of what is now in the book of Micah actually came from Micah. Ancient manuscripts, as I have mentioned to you before in this series, consisted of the basic document plus the comments that would be written in the margins and between the lines during all the time it circulated as a living, growing book. That very phrase sounds odd. A living, growing book. We print a book, copyright the text, hang on to the plates or mats that will let us reproduce it again in the exact same form, but for hundreds of years, documents like the prophecies of Micah were constantly growing and changing, expanded here and there by men who copied the book, copied it with occasional additions made to make it more useful and up to date for succeeding generations, but actually causing us lots of trouble and lots of confusion as to who wrote what and what the writings mean. I've mentioned that Micah, like Amos and Hosea, delivered his sermons in the form of poetry. Let me give you an example of that poetry at its best, because I'm going to give you one later of that poetry at its worst. There is a place early on in the book when Micah pictures God coming down to stride majestically across the earth, using the mountaintops as stepping stones. Each time his feet touch the hilltops, these great symbols of eternity, they melt like wax at the touch of a flame and flow down into the valleys like water rushing down a mountain. Now, did Micah think something like that literally happened? Not for a minute. But as symbolism, as poetry, it sang of the glory and majesty of God as no other form of writing could do. Like many other biblical writers, Micah has another trick with poetry that is even harder to translate well. He likes to pun, to play on words. English teachers call it paronomasia, because English teachers like to use big words where little ones would do just as well. No one ever told me about these linguistic tricks while I was growing up, even though I grew up in an intensely Bible-centered church. Even if someone had known about them, he would probably have felt that they might make us think the Bible was too human and not always as deadly serious as we should think. On my own, as a teenager, I would never have found them, because the puns are almost impossible to translate successfully into English. In fact, I know of only one man who has ever tried seriously to bring the hundreds of these puns across the verbal gulf between Hebrew and English. And that was the great old scholar James Moffat, who insisted on doing it 50 years ago so that the reader would have a more accurate notion of what the Bible is really like. People didn't like it. His translation didn't sell well. People have pretty much given up trying it. Now, with some trepidation, I'm going to try the risky business of demonstrating this odd linguistic playfulness. Very early on in our English text of Micah, he represents himself as going from town to town, warning that the Assyrian army is coming. It's a kind of daylight ride of Paul Revere. And as he tells us this, Micah makes up sentences that pun on the name of each town he comes to. You don't see it in the usual English translation. I'll read you a typical English translation. Tell it not in Gath, weep not at all. In Beth-Leaphra, roll yourselves in the dust. Pass on your way, inhabitants of Shafir, in nakedness and shame. The inhabitants of Zanan do not come forth. That puts you to sleep pretty quickly, doesn't it? But But if you really want to know how Micah was making his wild puns in Hebrew, here is the Moffat translation. And even though it's strained, it's true to the text. It goes like this. Weep tears at Tear Town. Grovel in the dust at Dust Town. Fare forth stripped, O Fair Town. Well, I'll spare you any more. But you can see how hard Micah worked at this little game and how hard a translator has to strain to carry his linguistic jokes across into English. Most modern translations do not even try. If you happen to own an annotated study Bible, there will be a note at the bottom of the page telling you that in the original Hebrew, the prophet has in this place a whole string of literary puns. You don't get a sample, but at least you learn a little more about all the different ways in which the Bible was composed. And I think that is useful information. Now, I tried to resist what I'm about to do next, but I didn't try hard enough. So here's an example of how Micah played this game. That is, if Micah had been a teacher in Kansas, warning us the way he warned those people 800 years before Christ that we better straighten up. It would go like this. O people of Dodge City, you cannot dodge the wrath to come. You will find no good in Goodland. Bellevue will not be beautiful for you, nor will you find healing for your sins in Medicine Lodge. I had to look at a map and strain a little. But you need to know that the Bible is a much more human and intriguing book than preachers have made it. And besides, I plan to include this material on your final. Now, let's talk now about a couple of themes in the prophecies of Micah. One is that he thinks the gulf between rich and poor is too deep and too wide for God to like. Unlike Amos and Hosea, Micah has nothing to say about the worship of idols or about sins of the flesh. He is red hot about greed and economic oppression, and especially about the fact that organized religion in his day seemed to be on the side of the oppressors. He goes after certain people who are so intent on exploiting others that they can't even sleep at night. They lie awake in bed, he says, devising ways of cheating their neighbors. And when morning comes, they rush out to do it, to trick small landowners out of their fields and homes. He goes after judges who take bribes and deprive poor people who cannot pay of justice. He goes after preachers who are ruled by expediency and self-interest rather than by moral principle. It sounds curiously modern, this hit list of Micah's. You have the feeling that in our time, he would be after the manufacturer who gets cheap goods out of sweatshops, out of the real estate owner who makes large profit from dangerous and unsanitary slum housing, after any employer so driven to make ever larger profit that he forgets the welfare of those who work for him. He pulls no punches. He really sounds, for those of you who have read these people, he sounds curiously like Dickens in his sense of social injustice, and like Dostoevsky. When he writes of such people that they tear the skin off the poor and eat their flesh and then break their bones into pieces and chop them up like meat in a kettle to be boiled for soup, no more concern for their human victims than a butcher has for the carcass of a cow. Well, you're probably beginning to understand why the 8th century Hebrew prophets are not much read. By the living standards of most of the world, all of us in this room are quite wealthy. And it's a little nerve-wracking to have some guy who claims to speak for God tell us that we may have forgotten both justice and compassion in our eagerness to go after still more. Pesky prophets have to be safely dead for a long time before we start building monuments in their honor. When we have to listen to them, they are mainly a nuisance. Dangerous to our standard of living, subversive, out of sync. I can imagine some of the radio commentators I hear declaring that without any doubt, they're either socialist or communist. But Micah has another theme, the one I've been emphasizing now for 3 weeks. That God has no use at all for our worship rituals and ceremonies unless we validate them by treating all other human beings with decency and justice. One of these great teachers, Isaiah, has God say, "Your incense and Sabbaths and feast days are an abomination to me. I am weary of them. I won't hear your many prayers. But here's what I want. Stop doing wrong. Relieve the oppressed. Judge in favor of the orphan," that is, the helpless. "Plead for the helpless widow. I am stuffed full of your burnt offerings. I don't like the blood of bulls and lambs. Wash up, get clean, stop grinding the face of the poor." We just can't get away from it in the writings of these 8th century B.C. prophets. God is a God who cares about economic and social injustice, and you can't distract his attention by taking communion or singing hymns or counting beads. Micah stands squarely beside Amos, Hosea, and Isaiah in telling us that all the beauty we create in worship, piano, organ, choir, repetition of the Lord's Prayer, incense, architecture, all the things that make us feel warm and happy and good are not in themselves religion. They are pleasures rather easily had where the exercise of religion, true religion, is tough, dirty, and as often as not, unrewarded by gratitude. People we help do not always thank us. Worship In other words, is easy. It's the practice of religion that's hard. The Greeks had a saying, before the gate of excellence, the high gods have placed sweat. It's a little more elegant, but it's not really different from Ross Perot's famous line, are we going to talk about it or are we going to do it? Will worship do its true work and inspire us to live better for another week, or will it be only a screen we put between ourselves, our consciences, and the wrongs that we don't have time to do anything about? How different all this is from those earliest books in the Bible, from all that endless detail about how to cut up a bull or a goat or a pigeon, how to sprinkle the blood, how to dress the priest, how to chant in unison the great Psalms. Now, all of a sudden, hundreds of years along in the history of the Bible, there is a major change in how the great teachers think about God. He doesn't really care about all this stuff. He cares about how people treat one another. The Bible begins to make the most marvelous sense when you read it as the record of a long, slow evolution in the way people understand God and what He wants. And so we come to the high point in Micah's preaching, to one of the greatest and grandest paragraphs in the entire Bible, or perhaps in any other sacred literature in the world. Micah gathers up everything Amos and Hosea and Isaiah have said about the kind of life that truly pleases God, and he rounds it off with what I have called in today's sermon title, The Noble Trinity, a three-part prescription for true religion that is so good, I will simply read it to you and close the sermon without another distracting word from me. Listen and translate it into the language of your own forms of worship. What shall I bring to the Lord God of heaven when I come to worship Him? Shall I bring the best calves to burn as offerings to Him? Will the Lord be pleased if I bring Him thousands of sheep or endless streams of olive oil? Shall I offer Him my firstborn child to pay for my sins? No. The Lord has told us what is good. What He requires of us is this: to be just, to be kind, and to live in quiet fellowship with Him.